KCAR 101. Get the 411 on your 911. Here's your host and emergency room physician, Dr. Lee Vinoker.
Hi, and welcome back to ER 101. I have Dr. Rade Vukmer here with us and Dr. David Piggott, both emergency physicians and experts in infectious disease and viral hemorrhagic fevers. So we were discussing the risk to the public, and I guess the point is that people are shedding much more virus the sicker and sicker they get. So you're not going to see someone that ill on a plane, being able to get on a plane, on a subway, you know, out in public. Isn't that true, Dr. Piggott?
That is true. Even though, as we've heard from the latest positive case in New York, that he traveled on the subway, he went to a bowling alley, that does not necessarily translate into markedly increased risk for other people who may have been near him on the subway or may have used the same bowling alley. Those people will almost certainly not get infected, just because the risk of transmission in the early stages of the disease is so low.
Right. But I still think that we need to be sensitive. And, you know, it's one thing to be a healthcare worker and it's in your hospital and maybe you haven't had direct contact, but to come back from Africa and just working with those patients. And, you know, I really believe even though he was following procedures, maybe he should have been a little more sensitive and just stayed home for 10 days and just monitored himself at home. For 10 days, truthfully. But Dr. Vukmer, so, you know, and we keep talking about to allay people's fears, you know, it's not transmitted by air. But a lot of people have asked me, and I'm sure you get asked all the time too, you know, you see someone who sneezes and they are spraying spit when they sneeze. But yet, even if they had the early signs or they had a virus, it's not really that you're not spreading it with spit per se or saliva as much as blood, correct?
Well, again, you know, it's the viral load that's important. And again, as we discussed, there is a sort of downward progression. I think if, again, you think about sort of the critical care isolation premise, you know, we use universal precautions, and that means any bloodborne pathogen. And again, as you pointed out in 1981 and 1982, when, you know, HIV was a new disease and, you know, it was sort of like this sort of self-discovery and patient and provider discovery, you know, it was a bloodborne pathogen. Again, this tends to be in the trauma sort of patient care group. And, you know, it's sort of a gown, glove, face shield, shoe cover type situation, but there was exposed skin typically. You know, we then move to what we would call sort of droplet precautions. And, you know, this is kind of what we see with sort of influenza and a cold. So typically, you know, virus-laden droplets are typically dropping off at about 4 feet. And then we move to true airborne precautions, which is not what this disease is. But this is where most of our efforts are geared towards, which are, you know, negative pressure rooms with external ventilation and, you know, N95 masks for the personnel. I think probably more analogous to this might be what we call contact precautions. And, you know, with recent discussion of Clostridium difficile, again, it was a sort of a liquid-borne pathogen, and it tended to live longer on surfaces. You know, Ebola probably drops off quickly, 2 to 3 hours. There persists some 1 to 2 days. There are some researchers that suggest 5 to 6, but most suggest it drops off relatively quickly. So, again, what we're looking at is sort of more liquid precautions, but in answer to the question, if someone sneezed directly on an individual in a susceptible area, there is some defined risk, less than with blood, but not no risk.
Right. And I think, again, you know, as we said, Dr. Piggott, it's until you're at that point where you're pretty sick, that the viral load, the amount of virus in your body has multiplied enough to really spread it badly, then you're bleeding a lot. You're not in the condition to bowl, correct?
Yeah, that's not going to be the patient that you're going to see, you know, on an airplane flight, you know, walking through the airport, passing by on the, in a bowling alley or on the subway, even as early as the day before his fever. The physician in New York was jogging 3 miles. This is not a patient who is going to be markedly viremic, spreading virus around behind him.
Right, and it's like we say about the flu. It hits you like a freight train, all of a sudden, boom. So let's talk about preparedness, because I think the example, you know, everyone was going down very hard on the Texas Presbyterian Hospital, but, you know, the there but the grace of God go I. You wonder about emergency rooms. You know, ER doctors, we've been sounding the alarm for years. I mean, we've done these health report cards, right, Dr. Vukmer? And we had been sounding the alarm saying, hey, our disaster preparedness in the whole emergency medical system, because we don't have support, we're the safety net kind of holding things together by a net with holes, was a C minus. So it's not shocking that they are understaffed, overworked, and overwhelmed with the number of cases that come in for everything else. So it was bound to happen. Don't you agree?
Again, you point out a valid point. You know, the American College of Emergency Physicians has gone through and done a survey of our different capabilities state by state and sort of given their state officials and legislatures the information to sort of make decisions on funding. It is a difficult day and age. There's not a day you don't turn around that there's not some funding need, but certainly in emergency medicine, you know, for, you know, homeland and domestic preparedness, those resources that come into your local emergency department are used immediately to benefit your population. There's been discussion about NIH funding, which is a separate question, but money that is put into your local emergency department through state or federal-based resources has an immediate positive effect on the patients in the community, whether we're talking about Ebola, influenza, or diabetes screening.
Yeah, and what's confusing too, of course, there's never a good time for Ebola, I guess, Dr. Piggott, but this is also the symptomatology of a viral infection that causes a fever and body aches right now, right? I mean, we're gearing up in our ERs for the big influx of influenza, correct? So this is a confusing time.
Right, if you look at the data, 30 to 40,000 people may die in a given year nationwide from influenza, and I saw a cartoon online that said, you know, something about all the people worked up over Ebola, but too busy to go get their flu shot.
Yeah,
it raises an important point. So if you said to the average emergency medicine professional, what would you advise your patients to do right now? You know, our advice as a community and individual physicians is get your flu shot. That will get you out of the mix to not be confused with patients that potentially could have to be screened for Ebola.
Right. And, you know, we always say during these times of year, you know, it's best not to be in an ER situation because, you know, you might catch something in the waiting room while you're waiting. But I think a lot of hospitals have put in pretty good precautions. I know mine, too. You know, we have very set things, and I think the CDC is changing. And as ER docs, there was an old saying, we still are mired in the, you know, influenza thing. If you hear hoofbeats, right, think of a horse, not a zebra. And I think you both bring up a good point that how many Ebola cases have we had in the United States, truthfully. So I think it's an important lesson for everybody to get your flu shot. This is ER 101. I'm Dr. Lee Vanocur on Radio MD. Stay well and tune in to your health.